The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Peer Pressure, How Well Do You Know Your ADCs? Cracking the Code of Targeted Delivery of Cytotoxic Payloads in Lung Cancer. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/UFJ860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Welcome. This is Peer Pressure. How well do you know your ADCs cracking the code of targeted delivery of cytotoxic payloads in lung cancer? I'm Ben Levy. I'm your host tonight and the faculty organizer. I'm joined by an esteemed group of physicians and experts in the field, Dr. Stephen Liu from Georgetown University, Dr. Marina Garasino from the University of Chicago, and Dr. Zosia Piotrowska from Harvard Medical School Mass General Hospital. Here are our goals today. Bottom line is we're going to go over the current ADC landscape, where we are now and where we're heading. Fascinating area of unique compounds that are just beginning to be leveraged in non-small cell lung cancer, learning about them also in different tumor types. Perhaps the most important slide of all, the rules of the contest here. For those of you who haven't seen this before, I will have questions peppered throughout this session. The panelist can try to, the one who hits the buzzer the quickest has a chance to answer. If you get a correct answer, it's 100 points. If you answer incorrectly, you will lose 100 points. And we will go through the leaderboard throughout here. You'll see how this goes. It's a lot of fun. Here we go. Which of the following classes of compounds is not a current payload for ADCs? Marina, answering quite prematurely. One, anti-microtubule agents. Two, topoisomerase inhibitors. DNA cleavage agents. Or four, alkylating agents. Which is not a current payload for ADCs?
Number three.
That is incorrect. Hold on. Zosia Piotrowska, what is not a current payload for ADCs?
Alkylating agent.
Very good. Round of applause for Zosia. Okay. Buzzer's ready. Buzzer's ready for question two. Question two. Buzzer's ready. Buzzer's ready. Buzzer's ready. Here we go. Question two. ADCs. Coming in with a different strategy that I was not aware of. ADCs often immobilize rapidly near the site of entry by binding with high affinity to target antigen, preventing the drug from diffusing further away from the blood vessel. This can lead to antibody sequestration and suboptimal tumor exposure, a phenomenon known as which of the following? One, oversaturation. Two, binding site barrier. Three, enrichment sequestration. Four, of course, Boyle's law. The strategy is not paying off, Marina.
I will never push again. Number two?
That is correct. Binding site barrier. Wonder the strategy has paid off 50% of the time. Steven, take us through the data.
Well, I mean, we've all witnessed this field sort of grow. And we think of antibody drug conjugates. There are some rules in terms of what makes it. There are four components. One, not really part of the drug, but just as important, that's the antigen. We want, in an ideal world, an antigen that's highly expressed on the tumor, not expressed on normal tissue. And the three components of drug that we think of for most antibody drug conjugates, the antibody, that's providing the specificity. We're looking for stability, internalization, the proprietary linker, either cleavable or non-cleavable, and the drug or payload. There we want something potent in the nanomolar range. That's going to be responsible for the cytotoxicity. We're looking at details as to how much drug is on each molecule. And I think we're still unpacking how these drugs work. Generally, we think of an antibody drug conjugate as a medicine that binds to the antigen, is internalized, and once within the cell, the linker dissolves, the linker breaks, we release that payload, we destroy that cell, and then that membrane-permeable cytotoxic payload is then entered into neighboring cells, giving us that bystander effect. But there are antibody independent mechanisms, payload-independent mechanisms, such as Fc-mediated stimulation of immune cells, ADCC, disruption of dimerization. There are a lot of potential mechanisms by which these medicines work, and we're still unpacking that a bit. One important concept, though, with ADCs is, unlike a lot of monoclonal antibodies, unlike PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors, which I think we agree are largely interchangeable, the same is not true with ADCs. And so even molecules that will have the same target can be very different. The details are what matters. Things like drug-to-antibody ratio, higher DARs will increase activity, may increase toxicity will influence clearance. And so all the different details here really make each molecule specific. And as you can see, there are a lot of ADCs we're hearing about at this meeting, many more to come. It's a field that's growing very quickly. We've gone from early generation drugs like T-DM1 to our next generation ADCs with cleavable linkers, with higher DAR, higher potency, better response rates. And the future, well, we're just getting started here. We're seeing bispecific monoclonal antibodies. We're seeing dual payloads. Right now, we're thinking mostly cytotoxic payloads, but we're also looking at immunomodulatory payloads, radionuclides, targeted therapies, and small molecules. Really, it's a platform and a new class of drug that we know is going to have a big impact throughout oncology. When you think of these drugs in rational drug design, we're also looking at ways to decrease toxicity, optimizing doses. There are new Probody drug conjugates, which are very exciting, where we have a protease cleavable peptide that essentially masks the antigen binding portion of the antibody. Once it's in the tumor microenvironment and near the tumor, that peptide is dissolved, and now we have access to an active ADC, further increasing the specificity, widening that therapeutic window.
Will you activate the buzzers? Marina, I forbid you from pressing the buzzer before the question is at least asked. Okay? Here we go. Which HER2 alteration is most frequent? Most frequent in non-small cell lung cancer? Is it a HER2 exon 20 insertion? Is it HER2 amplification? Or is it HER2 overexpression?
I don't know. But I didn't get a chance to talk at the last ones. Most frequent, I'm going to go with HER2 overexpression.
That's very good. Very round of applause for Stephen. Very nice job, John. Okay, it's that point in our program once again when we get the buzzers ready. Second question, again, Marina, you have to play by the rules.
Oh boy.
What was the intracranial response rate observed in the 5.4 mg per kg dose of trastuzumab deruxtecan in the subset analysis of DESTINY-Lung02 study? One. Dr. Stephen Liu.
I'm going to say 50%.
That is correct, Dr. Liu. That is very good. Okay. Very good, very good. We've got a tight, tight race here. Garasino's strategy has not paid off so far. But it's a very tight race. Okay. Stephen, take us through the HER2 targeted ADCs.
So HER2 really is where we have an approved antibody drug conjugate. And you know, ADCs are new to lung cancer. They're established in other disease types. We have one FDA approved, and that's really with HER2. HER2 is an important subset of lung cancer. We know these tend to be patients without a smoking history, but our early efforts to target HER2 using tyrosine kinase inhibitors were largely ineffective. Monoclonals are very disappointing, but really the ADCs, first T-DM1 and more recently T-DXd, have shown some very promising activity. We think of T-DXd, this is our FDA-approved agent. We have a monoclonal antibody targeting HER2. We have a Topo-1 payload and a tetrapeptide-based cleavable linker with a very high DAR, 8-to-1, much higher than the previous drug of T-DM1. This was first studied in DESTINY-Lung1, and back then we didn't really know the right subset to look at. We looked at HER2 overexpressing in cohort 1 and HER2 mutant in cohort 2, non-randomized, dual cohort. In HER2 overexpressing, the response rates in the 20s, around 25%. It was really in that HER2 mutant group where we saw very impressive activity. And if we look at this waterfall plot, this looks like targeted therapy, where most patients have a decrease in size of the tumor, where we're confident we're going to get some benefit. The confirmed response rate, 55%. The median duration of response when we use it in the first or second line was over a year, 14.7 months. Really impressive. And when we look at the downside here, the toxicity, it was really the interstitial lung disease that caught our attention. If you look there on the right, the rate of interstitial lung disease at this dose, which was 6.4 mg per kg, was a whopping 27.5%. Median time to onset, 125, but a wide range. Interstitial lung disease, largely grade 1-2, but there were cases of grade 3, and unfortunately, some cases of grade 5. So we're really concerned about this interstitial lung disease. There's a sense that this really could be dose-dependent. Enter DESTINY-Lung2, an optimization study where patients with HER2 mutant lung cancer are randomized to a lower dose of 5.4 mg per kg or that 6.4 mg per kg in DESTINY-Lung1, a 2-to-1 randomization. What we saw in this study is that lower dose, we're still getting a response rate around 50%. We're still seeing a duration of response here, 17 months, very encouraging PFS. But most importantly, at that lower dose, we're seeing a much lower rate of interstitial lung disease here, 12.9% compared to 28%. So a much more palatable tox profile, largely lower grade. We're still seeing very high response rates, quality, durable responses, this waterfall plot that gives us that confidence across different HER2 mutations, but a much more acceptable safety profile with a lower risk of ILD. And it's a setting where I kind of feel bad for some of our trainees. They go and they pull the New England Journal paper, but that is Destiny-Lung1. That's the wrong dose. It really is this 5.4 mg per kg. That's our FDA approved dose. Now, we were taught that larger molecules like monoclonals generally have trouble crossing that blood-brain barrier, and the downside of these is that they won't have CNS activity. We're having to rethink that. When we look at this pooled analysis of Destiny-Lung1 and Destiny-Lung2, we're seeing response rates between 30 and 50% here within the brain for measurable brain. That's 86% of patients at that 5.4 mg per kg dose with some reduction in brain lesion size. That waterfall plot, these drugs can work well in the brain. I've seen that in my own practice. It's very impressive, very reassuring to be able to provide some CNS penetration in this important subset.
Yeah, so let's just pause here. I mean, this is clearly the first ADC that's made it into the non-small cell lung cancer space. A lot of excitement here. We're going to have a trial comparing trastuzumab deruxtecan frontline to chemo IO. Zosia, your thoughts on this, and are you excited about this? Would you use this drug first line if you could? Do you want to wait and see the data?
I think this data certainly looks very encouraging, and I personally am very optimistic that that frontline study is going to be positive in favor of T-DXd. We at our institution have had discussions for newly diagnosed HER2 mutant lung cancer patients about the use of T-DXd first line. I think at this point, it's still reasonable to use chemotherapy, chemo IO, frontline, and use it second, but I do anticipate that that's going to change. I mean, the response rate here is really quite impressive. The CNS activity is also, relatively small numbers still, but encouraging. Yeah. I think those are all the things that we look for in a successful frontline strategy.
Yeah, it'll be exciting to see. Marina, just your experience with this drug, how you're leveraging it in your clinic and managing some of the toxicities. As Stephen mentioned, we're seeing these waterfall plots that look like targeted therapy. Is that what you're seeing in your clinic when you're using the drug?
Yeah, so the patients are responding to the treatment. I think that the problem maybe is the toxicity. And I think it's important the multidisciplinary, not the multidisciplinary tumor board, the tumor board with the pulmonologist to check the lung toxicity, in particular in this case.
Yeah. Stephen, comments?
Yeah, I think that when we think of T-DXd, while it has that waterfall plot of a targeted agent, we have to remember the toxicities align a lot more closely to chemotherapy. And if we're thinking things in mind like alopecia to prepare our patients, nausea, vomiting, we want to pre-medicate. I actually have found the drug, when taken in that right context, to be very well tolerated.
Yeah, that's been my experience too. I wanted to ask one more question. It divorces from the ADC topic and more about the HER2 space. We have some interesting drugs coming down the pike for HER2, zongertinib. Where do we see this drug, where do we see trastuzumab deruxtecan fitting into the algorithm here with all these new TKIs coming out? Is it going to be trastuzumab deruxtecan first followed by these new novel TKIs? How do we see this playing out? Stephen?
I think that the early data from some of these TKIs like zongertinib are very encouraging. We like oral therapies, but these are pretty high response rates, established entity. I think that when those drugs come along, we'll have to look at those data, and you got to wonder, are these maybe things we can combine?
Exactly.
Because the toxicities don't really seem to overlap.
Okay. So for the sake of time, we're going to move on here. This is an excellent discussion. We will have discussions after each section here, but it's time for more questions. Okay, here we go, panelists. Okay. Based on preclinical and clinical models, what percentage of administrated ADCs actually reach the tumor site? 1 to 2%? Marina.
Now I am terrified to go negative.
This is what we call an unfair question.
Maybe 4, I don't know.
That is incorrect, Marina. What? And
I go
buzzer's
negative.
Ready?
Terrible.
Zosia?
5 to 10%?
That is incorrect.
Oh.
Steven, you got a 1 in 3 shot. Go ahead, hit the buzzer.
Got to be optimistic. 50%.
That is so incorrect.
Can
it is actually,
closer?
You were the furthest away. Extra points deducted for Steven. Incredibly. This is a little nugget I don't want you to take back and talk to your other colleagues about. Only 1 to 2% of ADCs administered actually reach the tumor microenvironment.
Do I get the points because that was closest?
Zosia, good maneuver,
right rules.
Good maneuver, but no, you get nothing. Okay.
Rick, I tell you.
That was one of my favorite questions. There's a few of them. That's one of them. Okay, second question, buzzer's ready. Are we ready?
We're ready.
What was the most common side effect witnessed in the with HER3-DXd in the HER3-Lung01? Zosia, chance to redeem yourself.
Nausea.
Very good. Number, a round of applause to Zosia. Okay. Nice foundation here.
I'm excited to talk about this compound because I think it's one of the more promising agents that we have in the EGFR mutant lung cancer space, as we'll see. So patritumab deruxtecan, I think you'll hear some similarities to the HER2 section here. This is HER3-DXd. This is an antibody-drug conjugate with a monoclonal antibody targeting HER3. And for just to pause for a moment on the target here, HER3 is expressed in about 83% of non-small cell lung cancers. It does seem to be enriched in EGFR mutant lung cancers. But interestingly, HER3 alterations specifically are not a known resistance mechanism to EGFR TKIs. So although we'll see that this drug actually does have activity in resistant EGFR mutant lung cancer, it's not exactly clear why that is the case specifically in the resistant setting. So similar to T-DXd, this is a HER3 antibody linked using a tetrapeptide-based cleavable linker to the same topo-1 isomerase inhibitor payload, deruxtecan. And this has been evaluated in a number of solid tumors, but of course here we'll focus on lung cancer and specifically on the HERTHENA-Lung01 study. This was a phase 2 study specifically done in patients with advanced EGFR mutant lung cancer who've progressed on prior systemic therapy and specifically must have had prior EGFR TKIs, and in an amendment to the protocol also were in a subset of these patients required to have both a TKI and prior platinum-based chemotherapy. As you'll see will become relevant later, patients may have had inactive or previously treated asymptomatic brain metastases. And you can see here, this was originally a randomized study looking at two different doses, but really here I want you to just focus on the fixed dose of 5.6 milligrams per kilogram once every 3 weeks. That was determined to be the dose that was focused on, and a total of 225 patients were enrolled and treated at this dose with a primary endpoint of objective response rate. So these were the characteristics. Again, a fairly large data set here, 225 patients. You can see some of the key characteristics to highlight here. About 50% of these patients had a prior history of brain mets, including 30% who had brain mets at study entry. This was a fairly heavily pretreated patient population, a median of 3 prior lines of therapy. 73% of these patients had more than 2 prior lines of therapy. All of them had had to have a prior EGFR TKI. 93% of those had a prior third generation EGFR TKI, and 100% of them had also had prior platinum-based chemotherapy. 40% had prior IO. So here were the data, confirmed response rate of 29.8%. Essentially, if you looked at whether patients had had any prior TKI and chemotherapy, or if you looked at the 209 patients who had a prior third-gen TKI and chemotherapy, median duration of response was 6.4 months in both of these cohorts, however you slice this data, and median PFS of a respectable, I think, in the later line setting of 5.5 months. Looking at the forest plot on the right, you can really see that there was no subgroups that had a kind of a discordant response from what we're seeing in the overall population here, responses across the different EGFR mutations and overall kind of consistent data throughout. This is the waterfall plot. I think, you know, one of the things that's most exciting about this compound is that these responses are seen in patients who have a variety of different resistance mechanisms after EGFR inhibitors. So this is a drug that can work for patients really regardless of what type of resistance mechanism you're seeing, or even in that, you know, large group of patients where we don't identify a resistance mechanism. So I think a really promising agent in that sense. I think as you'll see with a number of these compounds, the responses do not seem to correlate with HER3 protein expression. So if you look at the HER3 membrane H score, there was really no correlation with the patients who had CRs or PRs or primary progression. In terms of toxicity, as you already saw in the questions, you know, many of these toxicities were really chemotherapy-associated toxicities, and I think that's a theme that we'll see throughout this presentation, that there are many of these agents that, well, when we explain this to patients, we try to say that this is really smarter kind of delivery, more deliberate delivery of chemotherapy to cancer cells. We still do see many of the common chemotherapy-related toxicities, nausea in particular. This is a drug that, in my experience, requires, you know, aggressive kind of anti-emetic prophylaxis. but with that can be well managed. We also see thrombocytopenia, anorexia, and neutropenia. But if we look at treatment discontinuation, only 7% of patients had treatment discontinuation due to AEs. One key point here is, fortunately, adjudicated ILD was seen in only 5% of these patients. So unlike the HER2 compound, with HER3, I think we are seeing relatively low rates of ILD. So the study is continuing to be evaluated in a couple of different contexts. There's a phase 3 study of this agent versus chemotherapy being done to evaluate where this should be positioned in our post-EGFR TKI space. And then an exciting trial combining this drug with osimertinib in the first and second line setting. So I think both really important data sets to keep an eye out for. And I think that's...
Yeah, very nice review, Zosia. Marina, I'll start with you. I mean, Zosia went over quite nicely where we are, response rates in a highly pretreated group of patients of around 30% that were EGFR mutated. So this drug clearly has activity. The drug, where it will land, we still don't know yet. We've got the HERTHENA-Lung02, which is post-OC randomized to chemo versus patritumab. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about this. What are your thoughts? Do you think this will beat out chemo? Now, I've heard different camps here. I've said, look, you know, some people say, look, chemotherapy works really well. Carbo-PEM, our darling child, works really well in EGFR mutant lung cancer post-TKI. Is this drug going to win out over carbo-PEM, you think?
Yeah, I think it's very early to say. I think that, but Zosia maybe will address this better than me, the EGFR mutants will be not just one category. I think that maybe we will shape in the future the treatment based on some other characteristics, the presence of the commutations, the P53, and we heard also that there are multiple different variants for each subtype. So I think that the future, if I have to think, will be more a personalized approach, mutation by mutation.
Okay. So not overly enthusiastic about the all-comer approach of that phase 3 trial with patritumab versus chemo. I'm interested to see how this all shakes out. Zosia, you gave a beautiful commentary at ESMO over the Mariposa data. Mm-hmm. You were the discussant for that data that was presented at ESMO, and you had this slide about how to sequence things on your EGFR for your EGFR patients. So I'll ask you the same unfair question I asked Stephen the last time we did this. I'm going to give Stephen a break here. So you've got now osimertinib, you've got amivantamab, lazertinib, you've got patritumab, deruxtecan. How do you sequence these drugs in the EGFR space? Where do you think this is heading? It's a completely unfair question, but where do you envision the sequencing for patients that are EGFR mutated looking at these different therapeutic strategies?
Yeah, I think it's an unfair but important question. And truthfully, I think it's one that we're going to be facing in the clinic. You know, really, we're already facing, but will be more and more so, I think, particularly with amivantamab. Hopefully, also, you know, now we have FLAURA2 with FDA approval. I bet amivantamab will also receive it. So it's a fair question. You know, I think that the main point in my mind is that patients have access to all of these different therapies. And maybe it's not so much the sequence that's so important as long as kind of, you know, these patients do ultimately have access to these different treatments. We really don't have a good sense yet of whether that sequence matters. You know, if, for example, a chemotherapy-treated patient will do better or worse on an ADC or amivantamab, or what that, you know, if you treat, for example, with amivantamab, an antibody-based approach, would that impact your response to an ADC subsequently? I don't know. I mean, I think that you could probably draw many different routes. I think right now, probably the most low-hanging is for patients with high disease burden, brain mets, to start with a FLAURA2-based regimen, and then think about, you know, in subsequent lines of therapy, an ADC or an amivantamab-based approach. But I do imagine that those paths. You know, the slide I made had all these different, it was like a choose your own adventure, and I think we're going to have to personalize this for our patients.
Yeah, I agree. It is a choose your own adventure. It's an embarrassment of riches, but it's adding a lot of complexity into our decision making. Stephen, you've had a chance, I think, to leverage patritumab deruxtecan under the auspices of clinical trial in your institution. Mm-hmm. What's your experience with the drug, and what do you think this drug looks like moving forward?
You know, to me, I love this approach, and it was really that waterfall plot that Zosia showed, where this is active, not just in EGFR dependent, but an independent and then unknown mechanisms. And while we focus on these cases where we identify MedAmp, we add a MET inhibitor in this beautiful, elegant story, we know that's not always the case in the real world. And in the ELEO study, which Zosha presented, the rate of paired biopsies was only about 39% on study. So in the real world, we can't always get biopsies. And more often now, I'm seeing a lot of polyclonal resistance,
yeah,
where we don't just see MET, we see MET plus an EGFR mutation plus a RET fusion. And it's nice to be able to reach for something empirically like patritumab and just have all your bases covered. I think there's really going to be a place for it.
Yeah. Again, very interesting to see how this all plays out. I'm going to bookmark a couple of things that we'll have at the very end of the discussion. One is, we're talking now about biomarkers and enriching. We'll save that biomarker discussion for the very end and where we're heading, because I know there's a lot of confusion and a lot of interest on what the appropriate biomarkers are for these class of drugs and how these drugs really work. We mentioned briefly the intracranial response, yeah, of these drugs, and you know, we saw signals with patritumab deruxtecan being able to cross the blood-brain barrier and elicit intracranial responses. I'm gonna put a pin in that too. We'll get to that because I'd like to get everyone's thoughts on how these drugs, which have no business in my mind crossing the blood-brain barrier, are eliciting responses in the brain. Okay, are you ready, panelists? Name this curve, Marina. What is this curve?
The tropion lung one.
Very good. Round of applause for Marina.
So I have zero.
Snap,
now.
Snap, snap.
Great.
Okay, we took out the names of the drugs, and it's very sophisticated, Marina, that you were able to recognize that. Good. All right, second question. According to Evoca 1 press release from last month, which subgroup of patients demonstrated improved outcome? Patients with PD-L1, Stephen.
It's real sensitive. I don't know if I pushed it. Can we go to the tape? it's patients who are non-responsive to IO.
Very good. Round of applause there. Paying attention to the press release so he can tweet it right away. I knew you'd get that. Okay. Let's move on. Marina, it's your time to talk about the TROP2-targeted ADCs.
Okay, thank you. We will go through all the TROP2, at least the most important. I'm sure that you are familiar with the Dato-DXd. That is, as you can see, there are three components. One is the monoclonal antibody, there is the cleavable part, and there is the payload, that is the deruxtecan. Why this is important, and this is why I answered the question before. So this is the trial that you have seen 4 months ago in ESMO in the plenary session. This included patients with stage 3 and stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer with and without actionable genomic alterations, and randomized the patient to receive either Dato-DXd or docetaxel at the dose of 6 milligrams per kilogram IV every 3 weeks. There are two primary endpoints, the progression-free survival and the overall survival. The secondary endpoints are the response rate, the duration of response, and the safety. It's important to remember that FDA considered the trial for FDA approval, so I'm really curious to see the end. And here you have the primary endpoint, which is the progression-free survival, hazard ratio 0.75, median progression-free survival for Dato-DXd 4.4 months, and 3.7 for docetaxel. As you can see, the pre-specified analysis was two-sided alpha, so the p-value is 0.08, and the response rate 26% for the Dato-DXd compared just to 12.8% for docetaxel. I think that what was very interesting of this trial was that I think unexpectedly we thought that there was no benefit in the squamous population, and you can see that the hazard ratio in the squamous population is 1.38, so there is a detrimental effect in this population, and while in the non-squamous population the hazard ratio is 0.63, and there is also benefit in the population non-squamous and without actionable alteration corresponding to a hazard ratio of 0.71. So remember, yes, in the non-squamous and never in the squamous for this drug. Here you have the interim overall survival analysis that I think when I saw it was, I think that was quite disappointing. There was much hope for the overall survival for this drug, but it's also true that the majority of the patients were censored. And so I think that we have to wait for the final analysis in the future. But again, you see that in the non-squamous population, the hazard ratio is 0.77, very close to the 1, and while in the squamous population, the hazard ratio is very detrimental and is 1.732. Moving to the toxicity, I think that the toxicity, there are less treatment-related adverse events for Dato-DXd compared to docetaxel, and there are less treatment-related adverse events leading to dose reductions or to dose discontinuation again for Dato-DXd. But I think that it's very important to talk also about the toxicity. The majority of the adverse events were stomatitis and nausea, and clearly the hematological toxicity like neutropenia were more common in the docetaxel arm. I think that it's important to mention three side effects. The first is the stomatitis. There is, in 54% of the patients, there is stomatitis, which is a particular stomatitis for the people who used the drug. Is a grade 3 in only 6% of patients, and there are not so many events leading to discontinuation, but we are talking about a population that is losing very frequently the weight, and also to have a stomatitis grade 1, grade 2 can impair the quality of life. There is also another particular toxicity that is the dry eye that is quite frequent. And in some patients, there is also the opposite phenomenon, that is the increased lacrimation. And last but not least, there is also ILD, and this is why I was saying before that I would recommend to find a pulmonologist to share these cases, because it's not very easy to distinguish what is the ILD, what was the previous toxicity, the COPD, and it's quite challenging, and maybe you don't want to stop a treatment that is active in these patients. Here you have the data of the Tropion Lung 5, just to confirm that the drug, also this drug, is very active in patients with genomic alterations, and you can see that there are EGFR, ALK, ROS, TRK, all the genomic alterations. And you see that the Waterford plot is very interesting, very few patients progressed, and on the bottom of the slide, you see that there are also some long-lasting responses. Sacituzumab govotecan, this is another TROP2. That although it is a TROP2, I think that what we are learning is that also if they are targeting the same target, they are not all the same. And again, here you have the monoclonal antibody targeting the TROP2 on the surface of many cancers. And then there is another payload, that there is the govotecan. This is the phase 1 trial that included, as you can see, a bunch of tumors. And the sacituzumab govotecan was administered at two different doses, 8 milligrams and 10 milligrams. And here you can see in the first results in non-small cell lung cancer, the response rate is 16.7%. There is a good number of patients who responded, as you can see in the Waterford plot. And you can see on the right that the toxicity of this drug, also if it is a TROP2 antibody drug conjugate, is different from the other one. So we have, in this case, nausea that can be controlled. We have diarrhea, we have fatigue, and we have always to remember that also if we don't have a complete alopecia, many patients are losing the hair with this kind of treatments. This is the phase 3 trial that for which we have a press release very recent. This trial included only stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer. The other trial included also the stage 3B and the stage and all the stage 3. And randomized patient to sacituzumab, govotecan, and docetaxel. The selected dose was 10 milligrams per kilogram. Primary endpoint was the overall survival. Secondary endpoints were progression-free survival, response rate, duration of response, and safety and tolerability. What we know about this trial is the press release that was part of the questions before, that unfortunately the trial did not meet its primary endpoint of overall survival in this population. However, the company is saying that there is a numerical improvement in overall survival favoring sacituzumab govotecan in both squamous and non-squamous. So I think that will be very important to see the results, and again, if we see the benefit in squamous and in non-squamous, is because the drugs, also if they are targeting the same biomarker, they are not exactly the same. I think that we can see what will be also the future coming from the preliminary results that we have in the first line very quickly. This is the trial with Dato-DXd with pembrolizumab plus or minus the chemotherapy. You can see that there are 6 cohorts combining differently the different doses with the chemotherapy and with or without the chemotherapy and with pembrolizumab. The primary objective of this trial was the safety, so it was not to see the efficacy, but also if it was not done for the efficacy, we can see the efficacy. And we can see that there are some good responses and also very durable responses in some cases. And in the bottom part of the slide, you can see that the benefit goes independently by the PD-L1 expression, also if the long-lasting responses, in my opinion, are higher in the population PD-L1 more than 50%. This is the toxicity of the combination. It's interesting because we see more stomatitis in the doublet therapy compared to the triplet. We don't know why, but we see that in general the doublet therapy is better tolerated compared to the triplet. And the most frequent adverse events were the stomatitis, again, the nausea, the anemia, and the fatigue. Same for sacituzumab govotecan. We have some results also in the first line. Primary endpoint of this trial is the response rate and the DLT. Again, a combination with immune checkpoint inhibitors in more than 50% and in less than 50%. Pretty interesting results in terms of activity and also on the right in terms of duration of response and depth of response. So this will be again paired with some toxicity, but the toxicity is very similar to what we observed also in the monotherapy, and there is diarrhea, anemia, and asthenia, and as I said before, there is also some alopecia, and on the right you can see all the non-immune-mediated adverse events. For both the drugs, there are ongoing phase 3 trials combining the immunotherapy and plus or minus the chemotherapy, and hopefully they will add something in the future, but I think that everything must be seen also in the scenario of the toxicity and not just of the activity. That's it.
Great.
I think it was the last one.
Wonderful job, Marina. I mean, we could talk for 2 hours about this data. We only have about 2 minutes. Zosia, I'm going to ask you unfair question number 2 to you. I know, this is tough. We see the data from Dato-DXd. We see those curves. They don't look that separating. There's, you know, we still need to wait and see what happens. With that drug, we've got stomatitis.
Yep.
That study allowed, it was a co-primary endpoint of PFS and OS. We see that with EVOKE-01, they just picked OS. We know from the press release that there was a numerical improvement in OS. It wasn't statistically significant. I'm going to fast forward here. What do you think the FDA is going to do with these two drugs? It's so unfair, I know. But what do you think is going to happen here? You know, and my second question is, why can't we beat docetaxel?
Both excellent questions. Neither questions that
you
I have a crystal.
You can phone friends, by the way.
Please,
if
friends.
You can do that.
Feel free. You know, I mean, I think we've seen that the FDA is careful about not, you know, they are not in the business of blanket approving things on marginal benefit with when drugs come at the cost of toxicity. And I think we've seen quite a bit of scrutiny for, you know, these randomized studies against docetaxel and, you know, what those studies look like, you know, what the outcomes look like. So I imagine that there will be careful scrutiny of these trials. And to be honest, I think that there will be, you know, a discussion. I'm not sure that these will end up reaching the threshold of approval. I mean, certainly sacituzumab, they've already said they didn't meet their primary endpoint. So that's tough. I don't know how excited, you know, the regulatory agencies are going to be about a numerical improvement if it's not meeting. So we'll see. I think the toxicity will also be really key here. You know, if it was a well-tolerated drug with some marginal benefit, I think that's easier. But these drugs also are tough. So we'll see.
Steven, your thoughts on this, and do you think there's an opportunity for these ADCs to move frontline? We saw some of the data from TROPION-Lung02 and EVOKE-02. Given the benefit or lack thereof in the second line, we'll see how the OS curves pan out, hopefully in the next 6 months. Is there an opportunity in the first line for these agents?
Absolutely. You know, I think that if we're talking about either of these TROP2 ADCs 5 years from now, I really hope it's not as an alternative to docetaxel. I really hope it's in the frontline setting, because when we think of how the ADCs work and their potential to disrupt the architecture, to sort of allow for more immune-mediated responses, if there really is a true synergy or some way to potentiate immunotherapy responses, then that could really move the needle, that really could improve outcomes. And if these drugs have relevance 5 or 10 years from now, it's because they're going to have an impact in the frontline setting.
We'll see. Very interesting to see how this will all unfold. Just a comment about toxicities, Osha, you mentioned, and any of the panelists here. Experience with these drugs and management of stomatitis for these for Dato-DXd. Does anyone have any experience with this, or you know, how do we move forward with managing stomatitis? And then same question for SG with diarrhea and febrile neutropenia. Will this toxicity profile be enough and be mitigated if it gets approved that this could be used in everyday clinic?
I will admit my experience with both of these is quite limited. I do think that, you know, with the stomatitis, there are some strategies that have been implemented that are prophylactic, you know, with prophylactic steroid mouth rinses, ice chips, things like that, which can be used, but I think also are quite cumbersome. So, you know, again, I think that if there is real activity seen, those things can help manage, but it's still a barrier. I think we're probably a little bit more comfortable managing things like diarrhea and some of the toxicities seen with sacituzumab. You know, those are things that commonly come with many of our therapies. So I think it's often a challenge when they're unique kind of drug-specific toxicities that are impacting day-to-day patient lives.
I think there's a learning curve with any new drug, but one thing we have to remember is that sacituzumab is already approved for other tumors, for breast cancer, for bladder cancer. Our colleagues there really have a favorable impression of it, so we know that can be tolerated. I think it just takes some experience and there's some time to learn.
Yeah, very interesting to see. We're wrestling with so many new compounds coming down the pike with so many different toxicities that we haven't seen. It'll be interesting to see if these drugs get approved, what those mitigation strategies are, how proactive can we be. I would agree. We have a chance here with both of these drugs to be proactive in mitigating some of their toxicities. We'll just have to see if they make it in so that we can exercise these types of strategies. We could go on forever here, but for the sake of time, we're going to move to our last section here. All right, here we go. Panelists ready. This one's kind of long, so bear with me. Here we go. Known as CD276, I'm a member of a group of checkpoint proteins involved in tumor proliferation and metastasis. I'm expressed both on cell membranes and within the cytoplasm of a tumor cell. Who am I? 1, CEACAM5, 2, B7H3, 3, CMET, or 4, DLL3. Zosia.
B7H3.
Very good, Zosia. That was a tough one. Round of applause.
Total guess.
Okay.
Buzzers ready? Hands ready. I was originally discovered as a pathway and published in Nature in 1984. Let me finish the question, because it took me a while. This was one of my favorite to craft. I've recently emerged as a potential therapeutic target for the ADC ABBV-399. Who am I? Am I TROP2? Am I CMET? Am I AXL or am I PTK7?
CMET.
Very good, Zosha. We're coming on strong, Zosha, at the end here. Okay, take it away. Take us home, Zosha.
All right, this is the grab bag section. So a few kind of emerging compounds to cover. Very briefly here, tucimitamab reftansine. This was a ADC targeting CEACAM5, which was overexpressed in a number of tumor types, including non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer. We're not going to spend very much time on this because despite some initial promising early clinical data, unfortunately, the phase 3 CARMEN-3, I believe, study was negative, and this program is no longer being moved forward, so unfortunate outcome here. Moving on next to ABBV-399, the CMET targeting ADC, also known as talisotuzumab vedotin, or Taliso-V. This is a first-in-class anti-CMET antibody drug conjugate. So here we have an antibody targeting CMET, which targets a unique epitope, as you can see here, blocking both HDF-dependent and independent CMET signaling, and this is linked to MMAE, which is a microtubule inhibitor. So this compound has been tested in the Luminosity study. This is a phase 2 study of Taliso-V in CMET-positive non-small cell lung cancers. This is a little bit of a busy schema, but I think that the main point here is this was tested in 3 major cohorts: non-squamous EGFR mutant cancers, non-squamous EGFR wild type cancers, non-small cell lung cancers, and then squamous non-small cell lung cancers. Recall, all of these are CMET expressing. All of these patients received Taliso-V at the recommended phase 2 dose of 1.9 mg per kg. And if we look at the outcomes here, really the bottom line is here that the activity was greatest, small numbers of patients, but greatest in the EGFR wild-type CMET-high patient population, where 12 out of 23 patients responded for a response rate of 52%. I think somewhat disappointingly, near and dear to my heart, but the EGFR-mutated cohort, even with high CMET expression, did not have very good activity. So the non-squamous EGFR wild-type population is where this is being explored going forward. In terms of toxicities with Taliso-V in the Luminosity study, I think the main ones to keep in mind are highlighted here: peripheral sensory neuropathy seen in any grade in 25% of patients, fortunately low grade and or a few grade high grade events. Blurred vision and keratitis were also seen, as you can see here. Pneumonitis was relatively uncommon, 6.6% of patients. And then lastly, infinitumab deruxtecan. This is an antibody drug conjugate targeting B7H3. This is a monoclonal antibody against B7H3 linked to our old friend deruxtecan, the topoisomerase 1 inhibitor, you can see here. And this is being tested in a phase 1 study looking at a number of different cohorts. You can see the dose escalation schema here with 12 mg per kg every 3 weeks selected as the recommended phase 2 dose. And I will focus your attention here on cohort 3, which was a squamous non-small cell lung cancer patients. There was also a separate cohort of small cell lung cancer. Very briefly, in the squamous non-small cell lung cancers, you can see 4 out of 13 responses here, 30.8%. Intriguing because many of these patients, all of them really had prior chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and taxane, so heavily pretreated. And then in the small cell population, I think there's a lot of excitement and interest in this compound, specifically in the small cell population. And indeed, 11 out of 21 patients with small cell had a confirmed response rate, again, in a heavily pretreated patient population. I think what's intriguing with this drug is that these responses, like with many of the other ADCs, these responses were not linked to B7H3 protein expression. So that does not seem to be the biomarker here. Just very briefly, in terms of treatment-related adverse events or emergent adverse events, most commonly nausea and myelosuppression were seen, but fortunately drug discontinuation, if you look all the way over on the right-hand side of the slide, was fairly rare. Only 8% of patients had a treatment-emergent adverse events leading to drug discontinuation. So with that whirlwind overview, I'll give you back a few minutes
Very nice job. One last question here. Audience, take a look. I mean, this is really, we're trying to demonstrate range here.
if this is a pop culture
question. Which of the following has not been nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars? One, Killer of the Flower Moon. Two, The Holdovers. Three, The Color Purple. Four, Zone of Interest. Not been nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. You got a 25% chance. Someone hit the buzzer. Okay, Zosia.
Zone of Interest.
Not correct. I'm sorry. All right.
Now we... The Holdovers.
Not correct. Steven, you have a 50% chance here. You're a movie guy. You're a movie guy. Which of the following has not been nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars?
I'm trying to think if there's a discordance between director and picture. I'll go Killers of the Flower Moon.
Not correct. All three of you. Actually, The Color Purple.
Really?
If you were to Google while I was creating this question, you would have found out that the snub this year was The Color Purple. Not nominated. Okay, guys, you know, we got a lot, 3 minutes here to wrap up. And I'll whittle this down to three questions that keep coming up over and over again. The first is, and these are just broad things to discuss. One is biomarkers. You know, a lot of these drugs, unfortunately, for now, minus trastuzumab deruxtecan for HER2 mutant lung cancer, don't have an enriched patient population more likely to respond based on something that we find on the biopsy. Stephen, how do we move forward here? Is it okay that these drugs work, you know, across a broad range of patients, or do we need better biomarkers?
Well, I think that in the short term, with a biomarker agnostic approach, we'll make incremental gains. But for really transformative gains, you know, we need a biomarker. It's not what we thought in HER2. You know, it makes sense for it to be protein. It's not. In MET with Teliso-V, it really does seem to be IHC. And so I think we need to keep working, because eventually I think we need to have them for all of them.
Yeah. Zosia, I told everyone we'd put a pen in this, but, you know, these drugs don't have any business crossing the blood-brain barrier. And yet we've seen impressive intracranial responses, at least from a pooled analysis from trastuzumab deruxtecan and from patritumab deruxtecan. I've actually seen this in our clinics as well. Your thoughts on this, and how does this shape your conversation with patients, potentially that may have subcentimeter brain mets who are eligible for this drug? Or these class of drugs, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think this is a paradigm shift in how we think about these agents. I don't think we have a good answer. I mean, there's lots of theories thrown around about whether, you know, the blood-brain barrier is disrupted, whether this is bystander effect and it's really just the payload that's getting through. Who knows? I think we don't really have a good answer. But I do think that this is real activity. Now, I would say for my patients in the clinic, we have to keep in mind this is not osimertinib or lorlatinib. You know, these are not drugs that we can rely on for highly symptomatic patients, nor really can we for those TKIs, but for sizable brain mets, I think these are, you know, drugs that we can have some hope for working in the brain. But I think if we do, you know, say we're going to start with using these systemic therapies and hold off on radiation, we have to watch these patients very closely. We have to get short interval follow-up MRIs, and I think we have to be mindful. All of these numbers are still fairly small, so I think we need to get a little bit more of a sense of this clinical activity to feel confident in what these drugs are going to do in the brain.
We'll be very interested to see with larger data sets how this pans out. Marina, last comment and thought here. You know, is there an opportunity to sequence ADCs? I mean, they're different payloads. Is there a possibility that if you start with one trope ADC and it doesn't work, you can move to the next if they got approved? Is that a possibility? I mean, is this just chemotherapy? We sequence chemotherapy. Can we sequence these drugs in the treatment continuum of a patient?
Yeah, so we don't know yet. I would say why not, because what we are learning is that, as I said before, that there is one part of the activity which is the monoclonal antibody, but the other part is chemotherapy. And so if the payload is different, I think we should collect the data and see, but we don't have the answer.
Yeah, very interesting. So we are out of time. I want to thank the audience for playing a critical role in this program. I want to thank the panelists. A round of applause for the panelists as well, who did a wonderful job here. Before, don't anyone leave, because we have gifts to give out here, okay? And the winner is, so we're going to do the winner first from the audience, and you do need to come up here. Can I do the leaderboard? Oh, no, we're gonna do the winner first on the panelist side. Dr. Zosia Piotrowska. Of course, none of our winners go home empty-handed.
Oh.
You get a plaque here that says Champion and Conqueror. Second annual Peer Pressure ADC event, PeerView Live, TTLC 2024, Santa Monica, California. And I personally signed the back. Here you go.
It will go on my wall for sure. That's really, I'm stuck behind this thing.
And then we have, do we have the, oh, Zach, sorry. Zach, come on up, man. Come on up. One would think he would be in the front row knowing that he got all the answers right, but he's the guy who kind of sits in the back and knows the answers. Congratulations. A round of applause for Zach. Thank you guys again. This concludes the program. We really appreciate it. Great time.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/UFJ860. This activity is supported by independent educational grants from AstraZeneca, Daiichi Sankyo Incorporated, and Gilead Sciences Incorporated.